Hi, I'm Libby Fulton.
And I'm Greg Greenfell.
And we like to garden.
Welcome, everybody. We've got a lovely, lovely guest tonight, don't we, Greg?
We do.
We've got Cassie here, and she runs a business locally in North Canterbury called Flourish Events. And she is a cut flower grower. And it's going to be very interesting to talk to her, because one of the topics we're going to talk about tonight is humates. But before we get started into that, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit, Cassie, and tell everyone a little bit about your gardening journey so far?
Hi, I'm Cassie. I'm a florist and flower farmer in Oxford, North Canterbury. I wouldn't really have said that I was into gardening. I've always liked flowers, but yeah, I was always really into outdoors. I love animals, anything outdoorsy. Love camping and going for walks and all that sort of stuff. I was a dairy farmer for nearly 11 years, and I had a few different injuries through my time. I'm not going to lie, I'm a pretty clumsy person anyway, but most people that are dairy farmers kind of will tell you that it's quite hard on the body. I mean, I loved it, but yeah, I got to a point where I sort of had to rethink where my career was going and what I was going to do. And we'd already bought this block here. I was still living in the North Island at the time, and my husband had moved down and was building our house. So sort of started looking at my options, and found a school in Christchurch that does floristry. So talked to my husband, and we decided, like, with no time like then, you know, we're already changing and figuring things out, so I may as well start new and just struggle once rather than twice.
That's really brave of you to make a huge career change like that. Like, you often hear from, I know some more dairy farmers as well, and nobody that milks is like, I want to do this forever. Like, it's very rare that you hear. So, but still, to make that big decision when you move down here, good on you. And now look at what you've got. Amazing.
Yeah. So, well, I quite like it, because you can sort of, like, I don't know, use the agricultural knowledge and background as well. So sort of helps. But I've also, like, since studying floristry, I've also studied horticulture, and I think I've made more links between what I was doing before and sort of the reason behind a lot of things that farmers do in a conventional sense, like just sort of more understanding the whys and the wheres and the hows behind it. So
I was going to say, the climate from, because you're from north of Auckland, wasn't it, to where you've moved to would be a massive transition, like completely different.
Very. Like what we were saying earlier on, before the rain that we've had, that would be the norm up north. So it's kind of funny being here, though, and what is sort of looked at as a massive storm here is just sort of normal rain for up north. But it's different climate and different soil. Like, it's so free draining here. Mm. I've had to really sort of get my head around how different it is. But yeah.
And I guess doing your horticultural course and things would have been so beneficial to learning on the job, literally, with where you are now.
Yeah, 100%. I've learnt so much about, the horticulture course that I did was about sustainable horticultural techniques. So that really helped me, not just learning about sort of soil science and plant biology, but just opening your eyes to more sustainable ways of doing things. So that was quite cool.
That's really cool. And so with your current setup now, what kind of does that look like?
A mess. Chaos. I have a few different types of beds going on. I have 250 meters of annual row beds across the front of our property, and that's all ground level. I put in a couple of bins when we were doing our house site. Everything that came out of the house site reused to sort of make a little bit of windbreak at the first stage. And in front of that, we've done a whole heap of like raised beds with sleepers, which has got a couple of our veggie beds, all of our gladioli and bulbs, rose beds, and dahlia beds. And we've actually got a whole heap of wood sitting there to do another 4 beds before spring. So that's another project. And yeah, our greenhouse next to it. And then at the moment, yeah, we're building a flower shop.
That's so cool. God, you're busy.
I know. So just to reiterate, how long have you been there now?
Well, the flower shop's been there for 2 years.
2 years.
Well, flower business, sorry. Yeah. It's about 2 years ago we broke ground on it.
Which is amazing. Yeah. So I guess I didn't explain this at the start to our listeners, but I was lucky enough to visit Cassie earlier the year, but it was sort of towards the end of the season in March, and you still mainly at that point had just zinnias left. Like a lot of it was sort of starting to like finish up. It might have actually even been in April.
I think it was like the last week of April.
Okay. Classic Libby. Oh, in March. No, it was actually like the last week in April.
I think that was like the week that we had the first frost, so everything had just toppled over.
She sees this, but we still managed to, there was what, 5 or 6 of us made these amazing cut flower bouquets, and Cassie taught us how to spiral them. Some of us were better than others at spiraling our bouquets. I was hopeless, and I crushed them to death.
I still got the photos. That was good.
you still had a lot of cosmos, and there was a few dahlias left.
Yeah.
But no, it was really interesting and seeing your beds that you had with the dahlias and what you did. But the one thing I kept thinking I must tell Greer about was how you store and deal and treat your gladioli, because you were sort of just in the process of like lifting them, weren't you?
Yeah, I think I'd just done it like that week, yeah.
So what do you do?
I wait till they sort of start to look like they've fizzled out, but the plant's actually still holding on to it, but it's sort of like on a greeny grey, and I just dig the whole lot up and wash them all and then let them dry. And then I just store them in a bucket with like dry sawdust. Once all the top of the plant has fully died back, I'll trim them lower, and I just leave them in a bucket. I usually put like a couple of layers of frost cloth over the top of them just to make sure that they are all right, and just store them in the garden shed until spring.
Okay, yeah. I didn't realise that gladioli were so sensitive.
They can be. They don't really like hard frost, and because we're so exposed here at the moment, like we get -2, -8, so you've got to like just be a little bit careful with them. I think they can handle a night frost, but I think once I'm a bit more established and have things a bit more sheltered, it probably won't be such a problem. But I've needed the space, so.
Yeah,
I'm moving them to a different bed next year. So, for this season coming, I've got a whole new bed for them. Last year, they were sharing their bed space with a couple of other things. So it's just because they multiply each year as well. It's quite good to pull them up and split them, and then divide them up for the next bed.
Mm. Yeah. And do you do the same with your dahlias, or do you leave your dahlias in?
This year, I'm leaving them in. I'm not too worried about them. I think I've just like mulched them quite high, above them, and like thick sort of sawdust cover. And like this weekend, because of all the rain we had, I went out and chucked some building paper over the top of them.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Smart.
Yeah, and they're always hooped with like microclimber, so dense frost cloth. So just to protect them. But I leave them in because they are in raised beds, so the tube is probably maybe 6 or 8 inches above what normal soil level would be.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, because they really don't like getting wet feet, eh?
No. I even had, like, when I was starting them last season, because I was starting with new beds, I started them all first in pots while I was just making sure that they didn't have gall or any kind of crap with them. A couple of ones where the pots were just sitting slightly lower, so they held a little bit of water. I lost a few. Yeah. So, but I've discovered that's also down to, you know, just how some tubers are just not very hardy.
Yeah.
And you can lose them quite easily. It's just one of those things. And I mean, I want strong ones, not flimsy sooks.
Well, because you're selling them. Like, I guess that goes back to the glitter. Yeah. Like, they're your babies and your income. But I didn't even know that that was a thing to wash them. Why do you wash them? Is that just to get the soil off them, or is that for another, like, makes them better for drying, or what is it?
It's sort of, well, it does sort of, like, you probably don't really need to wash them, but the bed that I had them in had a little bit of, like, it had clay and a sort of more clay mix and coir and stuff, so I'm just making sure that they've not got anything sitting on them that's going to hold water. But it's also a good chance to just check on them, see how they're doing. And yeah, I take that chance to, like, split what ones I can, because some of them have been sort of, I never split some of them last year if they were still looking a little bit small. So I think I maybe might have shown you guys that were there. Sort of the difference between the different bulbs, and you can sort of see whether all the new growth coming off the old ones. So they tend to, like, start sort of growing around in a knot if you don't split them all the time.
Which, because I've never grown gladiola, it sounds really silly. Like, I just thought, we have them at work in our garden, I just thought you left them to it. But the more, that was the biggest eye. But that's the biggest eye opener. I didn't realise how easy it was to split them.
Yeah. Well, it's like, for me as a cut flower grower, because they sort of grow around in a bit of a knot, I suppose if you're just having them in a garden, it probably wouldn't be so bad. But
the thing is
that they do grow up. So if you're letting them sort of knot, they will end up curving around rather than growing up straight, because you're trying to reach to the sky.
You're making sense. I have seen that. Then they start going outward, like, all side.
How you end up with bent flowers. So it's like, for me, trying to grow them to sell as cut flowers, I need them to be as strong and straight as possible. Yeah.
I guess you'd have to grow a few things quite differently, do you? Kind of, because in the garden, you know, it doesn't matter if things have side shoots and all that kind of stuff, but you probably have to be quite onto it when you're selling cut flowers.
It's mostly things like dahlias and stuff. You've got to be pretty good with pinching things out. Dahlias and amaranthus, a few other different things. And you've got to just sort of keep on top of them. And, like, it can look quite vicious when you're cutting flowers for market because you're cutting them for stem length. So you tend to, cut a bit lower than you probably would as someone who was cutting in your garden. You know, you're you're not really doing it to save buds.
Yeah.
I've noticed even when my husband would help me with cutting last year for the market and stuff, he'd go, oh, okay, maybe I'm not quite cutting low enough, because you're cutting off, like, buds, and, like, he would try to, you know, keep every single bud that he could on the plant. And it's like, no, you're cutting for florists. You need stem length.
You're like, you're just wasting stuff.
Well, it's like, the plant isn't going to hurt because you're cutting back more, so then it can grow longer again.
I like it's the going to grow back. You're like a vicious farmer, the vicious flower. Like, everyone else you talk to is like babying things a little bit. No, I get it. Treat them mean, keep them keen.
Well, it's just like, otherwise you're kind of conditioning them to grow short stems.
Yeah. So much sense. And have you done anything else over winter this year to prep your beds different from usual, or just?
I just do lots of, I work on soil as much as I can. So I mulched, composted. I put a whole heap of sawdust, which is like old sawdust from the mill down the road. So it's not it's not from treated wood, and it's been rotting down for a couple of years in a big pile.
God, that's handy. Having
it's
a mill
satisfying.
Yeah, so we have a big mill just down the end of our road, and it actually sold a little while ago, but our friends were the old owners, and so when they were clearing up, getting ready to sell, they dumped a couple of truckloads for me. So I've got, like, the next season or two just sitting there rotting away.
Amazing.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's what I mix a lot of that into the beds. So I did all of that just at the start of autumn, so that'll all just sit through winter, and then I'll just crack into it in spring.
It sounds like you've been busy already. I bet you don't think it's not.
What does the sawdust add to the soil? Is it like carbon, or is it improving the structure? Like, what does it, what's the main benefit?
Well, it does a few different things. It helps a lot with water retention, and because I'm so free draining here, and the property hadn't really been very well looked after. Well, it just hadn't had any treatment on it. I think it had had like Jersey bulls just sort of grazing on it for 3 years. Hadn't really had a lot of life put back into it. So there was a big pan and not a lot going on. So yeah, that really helps with water retention, a bit of aeration. Things like sawdust are quite high in nitrogen. So you've got to be careful with certain things. So that's why it's not really good to do fresh sawdust onto beds. So that's why you gotta let it rot a while.
That's really interesting. I kind of had thought you would have put treated wood, but my dad used to use sawdust, but I didn't really know why. But that makes a lot of sense, that it helps with aeration, but also with helps water retention too, which seemed like it would contradict, but I guess it's the shape of the sawdust particles that help with that.
If you think of when soil has a pan in it, it's so free draining, but it's compacted. Like, there's not actually that air there that's allowing water to flow, or to be sort of sucked in and held within the different soil particles. So it's sort of one of those things.
It gives it a bit of structure through to allow that to, and microbes and things to enter and help work it, which is that's really cool.
When you combine all that with like humates and seaweed and different stuff, it makes so much difference.
Shall we talk about humates? Because I had never, until Libby came back from your workshop, I had never even heard, like, it's not a word that was in my vocabulary at all. And I'm so interested to hear about them. So what are humates?
Humates are amazing, in short. They're sort of like a powerhouse. They're so good. Just all the amazing, but like kombucha for your garden.
Oh, I love that.
They are it's basically organic carbon that has 2/3 carbon, so it's 67% carbon, and it's made up of carbon, humic acid, and fulvic acid. It's basically made from like millions of years of decomposed organic matter. So it's like a super, super compost. It's the purest form of organic matter. It's highly concentrated into a solid material. It's sort of like one or two steps before coal, so it's very
dense.
Yeah,
is it?
Yeah,
yeah.
And so it comes out from like deep in the earth, kind of.
Is it like peat?
Yeah, sort of. It's peat is part humate. So basically, when you know how soils have CEC levels, peat has got quite high CEC levels. It's one of the closest soils in terms of CEC level to humate.
So I only just learnt this. You might know more about it than I do, but what CEC is, and it's the cation exchange capacity, right? Mm-hmm. And humates have a high level of that. And is that's like organic chemistry, like with the cations and anions, isn't it? So I don't really know anymore. It's like the basic of my knowledge. But does it help with the exchange of carbon with the plants?
What it does is, in order for like fert or any sort of minerals or nutrients to be taken up by a plant, when they hit soil actually has to be, I forget if it's positive or negative charge, I think it's negatively charged for most of the minerals to be stably held so that a plant can take them up. So you need soil to be able to hold those there. Otherwise, that's what causes it either leaches or it gases off. Most soil sort of depends. Different soil types have different levels of CEC. Most soils sort of have 12 to 14 CEC level. Sandy soils can be really, because they're so, not great, they can be 1 or 2. And in peat, it's usually 40 to 50. I have got sandy loam soil, which is between 5 and 10. But humates have a CEC of 250. Plus between 200 and 250. So, yeah, it massively affects how much nutrients are available for plants to take in.
So depending on your soil type, you can like feed it with heaps of fertilizer, but sometimes you might be overdoing it because that plant doesn't have the capacity to uptake it. So you might apply a humate to help the plant up what's available. Right.
So a lot of people that you've probably heard of it, regenerative farming techniques, people make their own natural fertilizers and they put on humate so that the humate is allowing the soil to be stabilized so that all the humates can do their job and help all those nutrients be actually present and held to be taken in by the plant rather than leaching or gassing off.
And so when you apply humates, would you always apply fertilizer as well, or do you just put the humates in the soil?
Not necessarily. Like, the thing is that humates aren't just carbon. They are humic and fulvic acid as well. The humic feeds and stimulates fungi, and fulvic stimulates bacteria. So you're also actually stimulating the soil to help break down more organic matter, therefore helping increase the carbon and nitrogen produced at soil level as well. So you don't need to do heaps of fert. Like, I don't do any synthetic fert. I put on a little bit of potash for some things, like dahlias, and I do a couple of seaweed treatments and with watering through the season, but that's basically it.
Wow, so it's just kind of like supercharging your soil.
Yeah, exactly. You're allowing the soil to help itself, basically. It's like a holistic treatment, really, for soil.
Wow. And how does it come? Like, does it come, like, in big pellets? Does it look like dirt?
It looks like really it sort of depends what way you do it. I just get, 8 kg bags or something that I get, which I use Dave's humate. And it just looks like coal, but a powder sort of thing. It's really fine black powder. But you can do liquid form, but liquid forms tend to be it's not really humate. It's actually just either humic acid treatment or a fulvic acid-based treatment. So you don't really get the same benefit of all three that you do with a powder.
Yeah,
okay.
And how much do you put on a bed? Like, say if you had kind of like a metre by a metre square, like how much would you put on?
Can't actually remember off the top of my head. I think it's something like 100 grams or something per metre squared. Yeah, it has it on the bag. In like my big long beds that I do out in the garden, in the flower farm, I do one bag per 24 metre long bed. As I'm preparing it, and that's
so it goes pretty far.
Also getting, it goes pretty far, and that's as an initial treatment. And I think I maybe used 12 bags last season. I'll probably use 20 or something this year. I've already treated like 4 beds with it coming into autumn.
Yeah,
but yeah, it doesn't. It little goes a long way.
Yeah, and is it like a once a year kind of thing that you do?
You can do it multiple times, I suppose. It's not something you need to do a hell of a lot of. Like, I tend to, all of my existing, like, trees and plants, things like roses, they'll probably get, like, a little sprinkle around the base of them at the start of the season, and that's probably it. Sort of depends on the needs of the plant, really.
And I guess you're kind of intensive growing because you're doing it for floristry, like you're intensive farming those beds for flowers, so you're wanting the best that you can get from it. if you are putting it in, do you do like any time of the year then? It doesn't matter. You know how like everyone sort of says sometimes it's better to apply like fertilizers in spring when, you know, when the plant's actively trying to put on growth. I guess with humates, because it's not accelerating the plant, but it's putting supercharging the soil, it won't matter as much. Is that true? Or
yeah, you can do it. You can do it any time. I wouldn't see a problem in doing it any time. Like, yeah, I've done quite a few of the beds that I've prepped coming into autumn and winter. I've prepped with it because with the humic and the fulvic, which is there for the microbes in the soil, you're actually like helping them sort of kickstart the soil and giving them something over winter as well, so that they can be getting established in the soil before you're starting out with the new season. Like, it's you know how some seedlings kind of don't really like an overly rich soil when they first get planted, and it can knock them a bit. Things like zinnias and stuff, they tend to go a little bit odd if they have too much active stuff in the soil.
They're like too rich, mother.
It sort of helps to prepare it. Exactly. And they get you get the occasional zinnia that looks a wee bit special the whole time. they get a little bit different growth, and they sort of start looking a bit more like daisies and not zinnias, and they never really do as well. It's just
interesting.
Yeah.
I would never have known that was a thing that they could go like daisies. But I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, like instead of getting full heads, they like come out as sort of singles. Like, do you remember like Rugrats, the Angelica doll? that's what I remember their heads looking like. I kept saying it to Daniel last season. I'm like, oh my god, it looks like that doll off Rugrats. So it's just like about three plants in this one like 24 meter long bed of zinnias that just, yeah, they look like they've been through the wars with a kid.
That's so funny.
Okay, I've learned so much about that humate. So I guess that really works well with your sort of regenerative gardening style.
Definitely. It's so good. And it also, because of its high carbon content, it increases the water storage capacity of the soil by like 60%. So massively helps getting water and nutrients there for the plants. And because most plants can't actually take up carbon and nitrogen unless it's bonded to a water molecule. So you need to have water there. Yeah, so that's how plant roots take up, yeah, those sort of minerals. They actually need to be attached to a water molecule in order for them to be sucked up. So you need to have water there. So that's why things like nitrogen get put on, like in a farm sense, they get put on. When there's water around, you can't do it without it because it just sits there. So, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I'm learning so. I feel like I'm at school. I'm learning so much. This is amazing. And so with your flowers and your business, do you belong to a collective or?
Yep. I'm part of Floral Collective Canterbury. We have one of the ladies that oversees everything, does the administrative side for us all, which is Sarah Andy. From Unfurlings Farms, and there's 7 of us growers that do it.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. We all love it.
And
it's
a great way to connect with other growers like in your area.
Definitely. Yeah. It's sort of, you'll kind of get to know each other and see different things that people are growing, and like there's, we sort of have a slightly different climate, each of us, so we can sort of extend the season out of it between all of us. Ladies that are in town, a few of the things that they grow similar to for the rest of us, they tend to be ready a few weeks earlier, so then we can kind of, yeah, extend that season a bit by the ones of us that are slightly more out of town and have a slightly more harder, difficult climate. But also it's so good to see different people's approach to things and sort of benchmark, I suppose, and pick people's brains. Sarah is an amazing dahlia breeder, so it's really cool being able to talk to her when you have a chance about different dahlias and stuff. When you see her come in with these buckets, these amazing blooms that you've never seen before.
Wow.
Blows your mind.
I was just going to say, you know, when you talk about extending the season, because that's the best thing about like the collective, it means someone's always going to probably have something available for the florist, because that's how the collective works, isn't it? You each put in what you've got going, and then it's not like 1 week someone's run out of zinnias because somebody else will be able to fill that spot. But have you got any of your flowers that you've found like you're going to do different? I think you kind of talked about it when we visited, that you were going to try and see if you could push out the season on them.
There's sort of a few things that I want to change single sowing to successive planting with. This past season was my first time growing stock, and I want to grow more of that and succession plant that, and definitely do that more with snapdragons. I was quite lucky that I did a second sowing of snapdragons, and I had snapdragons probably a month after everybody else had finished, which was quite handy.
Yeah. Did you expect that they would last or do as well as they did with that second sowing?
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
Because it was, by the time they're coming to flower, was when we had those really intense heat waves.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh no, why did I do this? Why did I do this? But they worked. They definitely don't last quite as long as the spring ones. Like the plant seems to push out an intense growth period initially and dwindles quicker than it does in spring, but it still did me. And I've actually kept those ones in that I did the late planting of, and so I'll sit, because they you can treat them as biennials, not perennials, but they don't tend to do quite as well the next year, so I've just left them in because they're in the end of a row that has stuff that's been kept in, and then I might rip them out and redo them maybe just for Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, that's good to know, because I had a self-seeded snapdragon that did amazing. Like, why are self-seeded? They're always so strong. Like, they just love it. But
hardy stems, hey?
Yeah, and it went all summer. Like, I reckon it was flowering for like, felt like months. And I've kind of just, like, left it there because I didn't know if it was an annual or not. I was like, should I rip this out? But it still looks okay, so I've just left it.
Just cut it back.
Sweet.
And see, yeah. You can usually, as long as you leave them a bit of stem and a couple of leaves, just see if it'll come back. You never know.
Yeah.
They're pretty hardy.
Yeah. Mm. That's the thing that always sometimes confuses, I think overwhelms me, but I guess it's a bit like trial and error, is you see like on the packets, like the guides of this is when you should sow this. And actually, if you need to push it out or you get lazy, maybe you've forgotten. Maybe something's happened.
Although, do you know what I did last year with my sugar snap peas? Because I was like, you know, they're like so delicious in spring. I just love sugar snap peas so much. And then in summer, I was like, can I just sow more? And I was like, I'm just going to do it. Like, it's hot. Mm. They'll grow, surely. They grew, but they were not good. They tasted awful. They were so bitter.
They get real hard too, eh?
Yeah, they were like real stringy. Like, they were not all good. And I was like, oh, yuck.
Was it the hot
same with beans, I think?
I don't know. It must have been too hot for them. They must just like kind of like that fresh spring weather. I don't know. But
yeah, I think they like the sort of in-between period, because most things that tend to go bitter, it's because it's like you know how coffee that's grown in some climates is stuff that will be, if it's in too hot a climate when they grow it, it forces it to the stage that it gets harvested too quickly, so it becomes bitter. It's not a mellow flavour, so I'm assuming it's the same thing with peas and beans, but I know we had that with our beans last year, and they were nasty.
I know, you're like, it's sunny, like, surely you like this.
It's too hot and too humid, so it forces it to seed quicker, and then it'll just be
doesn't too give bitter. It lessons learned. But I have really digressed, and I would love to know what are, like, this is probably going to be a really hard question to answer, but do you have, like, go-to favourite flowers if you're making your own arrangement for home? Like, what are your personal favourites?
I definitely do. Favourites, definitely dahlias. I love my dahlias. I grew Sebastian for the first time this season and I loved it. Probably my favourite. It's sort of like a orange through to pink, sort of peachy, but it like a has a slightly darker pink middle. Definitely a favourite. I quite like sort of oranges and pinks and things like that. I was actually quite surprised by how many tubers I got from it because I did. But yeah, I'm a big dahlia person. I quite like Cosmo as well. I think it's quite a good performer. It's really nice. I love it.
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever have a garden without Cosmos.
It's so pretty, eh? And there's so many different types. Like, it's like a quintessential cottage garden sort of wildflower looking thing. I love it. Yeah. And also amaranthus, but amaranthus is like too easy to grow. I ended up with it everywhere because it doesn't die off in compost either. I had an amaranthus plant growing on my garage door.
So I saw some of them and she had like these beautiful, like the burgundy and stunning.
It's so beautiful. It's so good using it as even as just a foliage, like you can cut it before it's like hit its full peak and use it as a foliage or use it as sort of fillers in a bouquet. Use it really dramatically in like artwork and stuff like that. It's definitely very diverse.
But speaking of like your style, how can people find you and how can they look at your work?
I'm on Instagram, Flourish Events LTD, I think it is. And I also have a website, which is flourishevents.co.nz. And I'm on Facebook and through the growing season, I sell through Floral Collective, which is more to florists. It's not really for the general public, but once the shop is open as well, I will have the shop open to the public, made up bouquets.
Watch this space.
And all my dried work, and I do like resin work as well. Dried flowers set in resin. So
are you having the shop open this season, this coming season?
Yeah, sort of aiming to have it open probably from October onwards.
Cool.
Yeah.
And you are in Cust in North Canterbury, is that right?
Yeah. Technically, I'm sort of like Cust or Oxford. I'm in between the two. Literally, the boundary is 500 metres either side of my house. So. Yeah.
Oh, cool. So, and then I'm assuming if people can follow you on socials and then they'll get that memo when that's all up and running.
Yeah, exactly. I'll put my shop details up once it's open and signs out on the road and stuff. I was actually looking at that the other day and sort of figuring out where I'm going to pinpoint putting my signs out on the main roads and stuff. Yep. So.
How exciting. You're so busy.
I know.
And you're available, obviously, for events and weddings and things like that.
Yeah.
And just quickly before you go, how did you get into doing dried flowers and resin? Are you, like, self-taught with that? Because that's really clever.
Yeah, I just wanted to have a go and try and see what it was like. I offered to some of my brides, like, preserving their bouquets. So I started with doing just dried ones set in shadow boxes and then got the hang of doing like pressed and set between like acrylic in frames and that, and then I thought it'd be quite cool to try doing pressed and set in resin, and so now I started doing that as well. And I've also got molds for like a little trinket dish and jewelry boxes, coasters and stuff, as well as like floating wall art ones. So
oh my god, you're very busy.
I had a bride recently that got me to make up a whole heap of like plate coasters, cup coasters and stuff, and like so she handed them out to like her family after her wedding. Like she kept some for her and she did like a jewellery box for her daughter that had her flowers pressed into it and to her parents and stuff. So there's so many different things you can do with it. And so I've got those on my website as well, but they'll also be in the shop. That's really cool.
I love that. That's very, sentimental to be able to do that and pass it on. And
Exactly.
Because you spend so much money on a bouquet and the time and effort to choose it for at a wedding or an event. So being able to then have it forever, because I tried to dry my bouquet and it was terrible because obviously I'm terrible with most things.
You've got to have a knack to it. It takes a bit of figuring it out. Don't worry, I had lots of trials.
So, that seems like a really nice idea.
Yeah, it's cool being able to, like you say, it's like it's one day and it's so much that you spend on it. Because some people spend an absolute fortune on their flowers, which, like, don't get me wrong, I love it and I get it. Like, you want those photos, like you want to be able to treasure it, but it's like you go to all that effort so that you can have the photos to treasure that moment. Like, why not
keep
treasure the flowers as well?
Yeah.
And have something that's sort of one of a kind, and you know, you can have your breakfast every morning on a coaster of your bouquet and see that every single morning.
You're selling it
so
to
cool.
me.
Yeah.
Well, I have to get married. Oh, well, thank you so much. It has been a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, it's been so amazing. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm looking forward to this flower shop come spring.
Yeah, so I'll definitely be putting it out on my socials once it's open. But yeah, I'd love to have you guys come and have a look and have a nosy.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to make a wee day trip out of it and come visit you. So that would be fun.
Yeah, to come through the farm when it's like full peak, not.
I know, yeah. It was still, she says this, but it was still amazing in the end of April, as we now know. We all made these amazing bouquets, so.
Oh, I can't wait to see it.
I know.
So that wraps it up. And for our listeners, we will see you, or we won't see you, but you can hear us in 2 weeks. This is an audio medium.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.